University of California Television presents this podcast of The Media's Financial Influence on Politics, featuring John Dunbar, Project Manager for the Center for Public Integrity. This talk was recorded in February 2006 and is presented by the Center for Film, Television, and New Media at UC Santa Barbara. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I'd like to start with just a little overview. Last week, the New York Times Week in Review section on February 5th, just to show you I'm not making this up, front and the back with a nice chapter. I can't show that on TV because that'll be copyright infringement. They presented a detailed report on how many congressional aides end up lobbying their former political offices as industry lobbyists. Some of this data came from the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. In October 2004, the center, and their website is publicintegrity.org, released Networks of Influence, the Political Power of the Communications Industry. The report examines the political influence of the communications industry on Congress. The report focused on lobbying, on campaign contributions, on industry-funded trips, which are called junkets, and government officials who routinely travel back and forth between public and private service, and we usually use the term the revolving door. Now, this is particularly important for the communications industry because it spends hundreds of millions of dollars to affect government policy, but at the same time asks and receives public frequencies, which are worth billions of dollars. Also, the media, of course, influence our opinions, our information, and the public agenda, only slightly more so than the administration today. The influence of these industries is particularly important given that they do control this information and they are really responsible for providing public service. John Dunbar is a principal analyst and writer for this really major influential project. He'll discuss the results and implications of the report and more broadly the role, structure, and political influence of media corporations in the U.S. John Dunbar has worked on the award-winning 50 States Project, the Center's Enron and Harkin oil investigations, and a report on the California energy crisis, very salient to us here. His 2002 co-authored book, Capital Offenders, How Private Interests Govern Our States, won the Investigative Reporters and Editors National Book Award. He's a graduate of the University of South Florida in Tampa, where he got a degree in mass communication. I present to you John Dunbar.
Thank you. Thanks for that introduction. Thanks for braving the rain. This is my first time in Santa Barbara. This is a beautiful city. And I expected sun, but that's all right. I want to talk a little bit about my employer. The Center for Public Integrity is a government watchdog organization. It was created about 15 years ago by a man named Chuck Lewis, who used to be a producer for 60 Minutes. And another, I think he was also an ABC Network news producer. Chuck decided that he wasn't able to get the kinds of stories on the air that he wanted to broadcast. So he went out and he created what we consider to be a new model of journalism. It's a nonprofit model, unconstrained by time limits, unconstrained by advertising, unconstrained by corporate pressures, I guess you could say. Chuck left a year ago, but his spirit lives on, and he was principal in making sure that this project that I'm involved with has continued and lives on. The center is a government watchdog, and I want to tell you that right now it's a wonderful time to be a government watchdog in Washington, D.C. It's like Christmas every day. Tom DeLay is getting indicted for laundering campaign contributions. Scooter Libby is going to testify that the vice president authorized him to release classified information to the press. And then there's Jack Abramoff. Has anybody heard anything about Jack Abramoff? He may be bad for America, but he's absolutely great for investigative journalists. You couldn't invent this guy. I mean, truly. But Abramoff is, or was, a lobbyist. He's basically an influence trader. Right now he's an indicted influence trader who has members and staffers in Congress on the Hill so scared that they're actually buying their own drinks right now. But when all is said and done, Abramoff is expected to implicate up to a dozen members of Congress, some say even as many as two dozen, over the next several months. There's a lot of tension around Washington right now, especially on the Hill. The center has actually been studying the lobbying industry for about 15 years, actually back since Chuck created the place. And for the past 3 years, as you can see, we've been looking specifically at the lobbying and political activities of the media and the telecommunications industries, and that's what I'm here to talk to you about today. But before I start throwing a bunch of numbers at you about that issue, I want to go back to this lobbying scandal again for a second, because this is one of those rare moments in politics where change might actually happen. Don't hold your breath. Congress is in the midst of trying to reform this lobbying system as we speak, basically by preventing lobbyists from paying for golf outings and dinners for members of Congress and their staff. This is a good start. I mean, we don't really advocate that anybody does anything in Washington. We really are a non-advocacy group, but it's kind of hard to think that it's a good idea for a guy who wants a congressman to pass legislation that helps his company, that they're going to Morton's Steakhouse and having drinks and going out and playing golf in Scotland. But regardless, as bad as that sounds, it's actually kind of minor on the scheme of things. The real lobbyists, by the way, lobbyists are not bad people. Some of my best friends are lobbyists. I have one friend who's a lobbyist for the baked goods industry. He had to, this is an aside here, he had to go on TV to defend carbohydrates once. This was during the Atkins craze. And we talked about it before he made his appearance, and it was he did a great job, and you know he was right. He said it's a fun food. It's carbohydrates are fun. You know, I don't eat them all the time. And I was like, I was very proud of him for that. Anyway, so don't get mad at the lobbyists. Get mad at the system. A lobbyist functions as a middleman. A lobbyist is part of the machinery of influence. The lobbyist brings together mostly large corporations, and elected officials. They arrange for large sums of money to be transferred to campaigns of these elected officials. In return, these elected officials make sure the interests of these businesses are protected. It's a symbiotic relationship. It's also a private party, and you and I are not invited. We did a study not long ago that showed that there are nearly 80 members of Congress who have lobbyists acting as treasurers of their campaigns. The lobbyists are just a conduit for corporate cash. I mean, think about this for a second. This is the treasurer of your campaign, whose job is to make sure that you're getting enough money so that you can be reelected, is also representing the corporations that are benefiting from the policies that this member of Congress, that they're being the treasurer for, wants to get through the system. If you really want to reform lobbying, if you really want to get people excited in Washington, pass a law that would ban lobbyists from being able to be the conduit for this corporate cash into these campaigns. Fat chance. Good luck. That truly goes to the heart of the system itself. That actually affects the machinery of the way Washington works. As Ron said, I'm a director of a project at the center called Well Connected. Please visit our website if you get a chance. It's publicintegrity.org/telecom if you'd like to go right to this page to learn more. I've also brought a couple of items over here, a brochure describing the website and some of the tools that are on the site so that you can learn about media ownership and also learn about the political influence, get some numbers, find out how much various companies are spending to lobby and whether they like Democrats and whether they like Republicans, et cetera. This project was an attempt by the center to investigate the political influence of the communications industry in America. First, I want to explain what I mean by the communications industry. Initially, we thought about just sticking with media, but realized that that was really going to kind of fall short because the way the information industry is changing right now, it's becoming really difficult to even decide what media actually is. But you still have to figure out some way to talk about this stuff. It took a really long time just to figure out what the definition of telecommunications was. And honestly, what it was 3 years ago was not what it is today. And I think about it differently every day, every time there's new technology that comes down the pike, every time there are new regulatory battles in Congress. I have to keep sort of rearranging my definition of what telecom is and what media is. But having said that, we did have to figure out some way to look at it, and we did it this way. I split the business basically into three categories. Traditional telephone companies, cable television companies, and broadcasters. These categories, just in the past few years, have been steadily bleeding into one another. And I'll get a little bit more into that when I talk about what's happening in Washington right now, and that'll be towards the end of my talk. I think you can also define these industries as pipeline companies. I'm especially interested in a business that controls the information pipelines that come into your homes, be they through a phone line, be they through a cable line, or be they through over the air, through the airwaves. This project has always been, since the beginning, about control. It's really easy to overthink the technology industry. You get distracted by gadgets. Don't get distracted by gadgets. The bottom line is there are these lines of communication, lines of mass communication that are coming into your home, and that they are controlled by generally very large industries. And whether you know it or not, that's how you find out about what's going on in the world. Now, what's different about examining this industry and its influences, this is the only industry that I know of that can actually affect the way you think about how they do their business, and you don't know it. It's a little creepy. I think one of the reasons why the media ownership issue got so popular back in 2003, although you won't see much about it right now, this is a continuing fight over how big media companies should be allowed to get. I think that the reason that registered for a lot of people was they started to understand that this was an issue about control, that this was an issue about controlling information as it goes into your home. Now, back in the Orwellian concept of Big Brother, we were thinking more along the lines of government control of information, and believe me, we're expanding this project globally right now, which is daunting, to say the least. There are countries where there is an Orwellian system that governs media. Believe me, there are a lot of them. In this country, not so much the government control of information, more the commercial flow of information. And sometimes I'm not sure which is more scary. Probably the government's more scary because they'll kill you. Generally, the Viacoms of the world are not going to come after you with guns. But you get the idea. This was the philosophy behind the project. We want to make sure that we want to take a hard look at these companies that are actually controlling these lines of mass communication, as we call them, regardless of what their platform is. Well, once we defined this universe, basically these three subcategories, we started our analysis and used what I like to call the influence troika approach. I was a newspaper reporter before I came to the center. I've been at the center for 6+ years. I'm still consider myself to be a journalist. I just take longer to write my stories. But generally in journalism, when you want to examine influence in government, there's three good areas that you should take a look at. One is campaign contributions, which pretty much everybody knows about. The other is lobbying. And then the third, which we like to collect just because it's fun and it ticks people off, are what we call junkets or industry-funded trips, which makes news constantly. When we first started this project, did what would be a Journalism 101 course class story idea, And we collected 8 years of trips by the Federal Communications Commission, paid for by industry. Found out that there was almost $3 million worth of travel paid for by companies that the FCC was making regulatory decisions about. And these guys were flying them all over the place. They were going to Paris, and the most popular destination was Las Vegas. And reading through these forms was a lot of fun, frankly, when you find that your Federal Communications Commission is staying at the Bellagio in Las Vegas when you were at the 8N the last time that you were there. That was a surprisingly easy project to do because it was open season for us. Unfortunately, in Washington, the news industry doesn't do a really good job of covering federal agencies, and I've never quite been sure why that is. When we were looking at the Federal Communications Commission, we were amazed at how easy it was to do that story, and we were amazed at the fact that no one had done it before. This isn't rocket science. I mean, you talk to anybody who's taken any kind of journalism at all, it's like, are they traveling on the industry's dime, and you do that story. Not long after that story hit, they stopped doing it. And it was a couple of members of Congress who became very vocal and said that they don't think that this is a very good idea. Michael Powell, who was the chairman of the FCC at the time, grudgingly said, you're probably right, this isn't a very good idea, so they stopped doing it. They never passed a law, though, so I don't know if they're still traveling on the industry's dime or not. We'll see. We'll file another Freedom of Information Act probably in another 6 months, and I'll find out. I'll let you know. Well, once we defined our universe, we started collecting these numbers from these various areas. According to our most recent analysis, which is updated in my chapter in Ron's upcoming book, which I'm sure he'll tell you about at some point, industry sectors spent a cool billion dollars on these political activities between 1998 and 2004. That's billion with a B, not million, over 6 years. Just as a breakdown to show you how much they're spending and who's spending the most, telephone companies, the traditional telephone companies, like Verizon AT&T, actually AT&T and SBC are the same now, spent $436 million on lobbying over this period of time, $65 million on campaign contributions, and $280,000 on trips for an overall total of $502 million. So about half of that billion came from the traditional telephone companies. Broadcasters spent $204 million on lobbying and $30 million on campaign contributions, and $160,000 on trips for a total of $234 million. Cable television providers spent $116 million on lobbying, $26 million on contributions, and $230,000 on trips for a total of $142 million. About lobbying, total lobbying expenditures in this, what I call the communications industry, from 98 to 2004, lobbying alone, just to give you an idea of how big of an industry lobbying, and it was accounted for $840 million of that $1 billion that I was telling you about. Campaign contributions are extremely important. They're a big deal in Washington, but they're absolute chump change compared to lobbying. It costs so much more to run a lobbying organization, and lobbyists are so much more expensive. This $840 million affected legislation ranging from local telephone competition to media consolidation to the deregulation of the cable industry, or I should say the re-regulation of the cable industry. Spending on lobbying by communications companies during that period rose from $119 million in 1998 to $142 million in 2004. That's an increase of about 19%. It's a great industry. It's nice work if you can get it. And it's also a growth industry. I don't expect these current reforms to make the numbers go down anytime soon. The top lobbying organization is the General Electric Company, which owns 80% of NBC Universal. They spent $94.1 million. This may be a little bit misleading because obviously General Electric does a lot more than own a TV company and network, actually. Only about 5 or 6% of their revenue comes from NBC Universal. That gives you an idea how big GE is. It's a huge company. But you have to look at, you know, we thought long and hard about whether to include all of that money that they spent on lobbying. And at the end of the day, it's the organization. The organization has priorities in Congress. And when Bob Wright, who's the chairman of NBC, who's also a vice chairman of the General Electric overall, walks into somebody's office and says, I have an opinion about how media ownership proceedings should go, people listen to what he has to say. Second behind General Electric was Verizon Communications. It's the nation's, well, it was the nation's largest phone company. You really have to keep up. Now it's the nation's second largest phone company, thanks to SBC merging with AT&T. The former Bell operating company, that was Bell, it was actually a merger of Bell Atlantic and GTE and a half a dozen other companies. They spent $81 million, almost $82 million from 1998 through 2004. Verizon obviously has key interests in local and long-distance phone regulation, spectrum allocation for its wireless division, and a multitude of other issues. Third on the top lobby spending list was SBC at $58 million. SBC was followed by AT&T at $53 million. And Sprint at $47 million. And what's interesting about SBC is one of the most sophisticated lobby shops in Washington was with AT&T. Even when they were sort of dying their last breath over the last couple of years, they were still spending millions, tens of millions of dollars on lobbying. And when SBC and AT&T merged, they had to consolidate that lobbying force. So there's a lot of angst going on in the lobbying ranks on K Street when those guys got together. As far as contributions, campaign contributions through 1998 through 2004 were $160 million for $160 million, including both hard and soft money donations from industry employees, labor unions, representing employees in the communications industry, and political action committees. The two largest contributors over the study period were both labor unions. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers spent $13.4 million since 1998. Second was the Communications Workers of America at $13 million. Third on the list of top contributors to the contributors in the communications industry was Verizon at $11.4 million. Verizon was followed by SBC at $11.3 million. And then, and I'm talking about the communications industry overall. Third, we get Time Warner, which has holdings in publishing, film production, internet, and cable with $9 million. There's always a lot of conversation about the media and whether it's right wing or left wing or no wing. I always get a big kick out of listening to people talk about whether they're right wing or left wing. They're money wing. They're about shareholders. They're not about ideology. I told a story earlier, actually today, about somebody interviewing me for a documentary about Rupert Murdoch, and I apparently didn't say what they wanted to hear, which was the reason that Rupert Murdoch was right-wing was basically because he wanted to break up the labor unions in England when he was running his newspapers there. And if Murdoch thought that that leftism would help his profits, he'd be wearing a hammer and sickle tomorrow, basically. He's not an ideologue. And if you look at page three at some of his tabloids, and you'll understand how much of a conservative that he truly is. Watch him in New York, by the way. Watch what he does in New York with the New York Post and Hillary Clinton. We'll see what his conservative bona fides are. Anyway, I didn't make it in the documentary. I don't think they wanted to hear that. I guess you can be too cynical. The presidential election, last presidential election, didn't hold too many surprises. The front runner was George Bush, and he led by a fairly large margin. Republicans are just better at raising money than Democrats. It's a fact. Businesses generally, especially the large telephone companies, find that the Republican Party is more helpful to their agenda. But that's not always the case. But back to the partisan preference. So if you look at the communications industry as a whole, they lean towards the Democratic Party, at least during the period that we looked at, which was 98 through 2004. Total contributions were split 56.2% for Democratic candidates and party organizations and 43.2% for Republicans. It breaks down a little bit differently depending on which industry that you're looking at. The phone companies, like I said, tend to be a little bit more Republican. You also have to consider, before anybody does any ahas on me, contributions change depending on who's in power. It's probably incredibly obvious to a lot of you, but I'm not. If I'm a corporation, I'm not going to go out and spend a huge amount of money on somebody who's going to lose. I'm probably going to stick with the incumbent to make sure that he stays there. Unless he's somebody who I really don't like, then maybe I'll try and find somebody that I can prop up and run against him. But generally, you're going to find more money spent on incumbents, and that's one of the reasons why we have this unbelievable incumbent retention system in the U.S. right now. It's very difficult to unseat a sitting member of Congress. We'll see up in these upcoming midterms what happens, but generally it's pretty tough to get rid of an incumbent. Well, there's also something called bundling, which this is sort of a rather new, but it's a way to get around campaign finance laws. Basically, you go out and you find somebody, usually a lobbyist, who goes out and gets contributions together from all of his buddies, and then they put those contributions together and they track them. The Bush campaign was a genius, was just brilliant at this, and they give you cool names like Ranger and... and the communications industry has quite a few of these. The Pioneer was the first one. There's at least 10 figures in that industry that raised $100,000 or more for President Bush's reelection. One of the pioneers was Salem Communications CEO Edward Atzinger. I don't know if you know much about Salem. It's a very, very aggressive radio company that's been growing very rapidly and has a it's a bulk of it is religious broadcasting. There's IDT Corporation CEO James Corder, lobbyist Ronald Kaufman, senior managing partner of the Dutco Group, which is another big lobbying and law firm in Washington. Liggett Communication CEO Robert Liggett, lobbyist and former member of Congress Bill Paxon of Aiken, Gump, Strauss, Hauer, and Feld. Univision Communication CEO Jerry Perenchio. Univision, by the way, is apparently up for sale. If you're looking for more consolidation, it's continuing to happen. And we also have Ivan Seidenberg, who is among the most powerful men in the communications industry right now. He's the CEO of Verizon. He's been a lot more public lately. And then SBC's communications, actually now AT&T again, CEO Edward Whitaker, who was a Ranger because he raised $200,000 for George Bush. Closely related to lobbying is what we call this. Junkets. This is fact-finding trips by lawmakers and staff. From 2000 through March 2004, we found that the communications industry sponsored 450 trips for members and staff of Congress, members, their family, and staff of the House and Senate Commerce Committees. These trips were valued at $700,000. The top sponsor was an organization that you may never have heard of, but carries a lot of weight in Washington. It's the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. They funded 102 trips worth $198,000. Second was the United States Telecom Association with 62 trips at $106,000. Third was SBC with 47 trips. And fourth was my favorite Washington lobby, which is the National Association of Broadcasters, which paid for 43 trips at almost $100,000. Now, it's interesting to see who is taking all of these trips. In this particular case, because we were looking at the Commerce Committees, which is where most of this legislation comes from, the frequent flyer award was no contest. The top recipient was now retired Louisiana Representative Billy Tozan. He was the former chairman of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, as I mentioned. Tozan and members of his office went on 69 trips valued at $107,424. Tozan was the top traveler in every communication sector examined by the center. He's no longer in office, but to follow a pattern which we see a lot, he is now a lobbyist, of course. Now he has gone to work for probably the only lobby in Washington that has more power than the National Association of Broadcasters, and that is the pharmaceutical industry. We also looked at something called revolving doors, which is a sort of influence that's a bit more insidious, and it's also quite a bit more difficult to track. Some call it capture theory. I've never really studied economics, but the idea is that when your regulators are basically taken over by the industries that they're regulating. And it's extremely obvious when someone calls you up and you recognize the name, but you can't remember whether they're working for the government now or working for industry. And this has actually happened to me because they go back and forth so often. We actually tried to find out how many people have actually left their government jobs and gone into private industry. And we came up with a number, 398. That was over 4 years. 398 people had left government and gone to work for companies that they used to regulate. By way of example, all eight previous chairmen of the Federal Communications Commission have either worked for or represented corporations that are regulated by the agency. Two are actually registered lobbyists. I wanted to break down these. I'm actually running out of time, so I'm going to speed up a little here and cut out some of these numbers. You get numb to the numbers, I know. If I just kind of sit up here and feed a bunch of numbers at you, it kind of doesn't mean anything so well. The broadcast industry, which I think people are more interested in, will be more interested in as the media ownership consolidation debate starts to heat up again this summer, and that is going to happen this summer. Spent $204 million lobbying the federal government from 98 through 2004. Also made $30.1 million in contributions to federal candidates and lawmakers during that period. The National Association of Broadcasters, as I had mentioned before, sponsored 84 trips for lawmakers. These are these junkets that we talk about. From 2000 through March 2004 at a cost of $160,000. This is bringing total spending to affect policy and elections by the industry to a minimum of $235 million. We also saw 24 individuals with close ties to both the industry and its regular overseers move back and forth, go back and forth from the FCC to lobbying jobs or industry at least once. Most interesting to me in terms on the broadcast side is that from 98 through 2004, the lobbying expenditures by the industry rose 80%. They spent $20 million in 1998. They spent $36 million in 2004. I think you can tie this to the continuing debate over media consolidation, because that was right during that period of time. And I'll talk about media consolidation in a minute when I show you our cool media ownership database. Tops in lobbying was General Electric at $94 million. Second is the National Association of Broadcasters. The NAB spent $42.9 million on lobbying. Walt Disney, owner of ABC, was a distant third at $23.6 million. I'm going to bear with me for a second because I'm going to skip through here because we are definitely running out of time. I wanted to talk for a second about some of the more interesting revolvers. We call them revolvers. These are people who go back and forth from business to industry. In the broadcast industry, there's some two dozen individuals that moved through this door that is between the industry and the government. One of my favorites, who's actually a very nice person, is Marcia McBride, who's currently the NAB's Executive Vice President for Legal and Regulatory Affairs. She has ping-ponged at a dizzying clip over the last 13 years. She went from the industry to the FCC, back to the industry, and then back to the FCC again, before landing, at least for now, at the National Association of Broadcasters. Clear Channel, which plays a big role in this media market here in Santa Barbara, and I'll show you that in a second, had virtually no Washington lobbying presence for years. Then it got into the Lee-influenced business in a big way when it hired Andrew Levin. Levin was the minority counsel for the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, where virtually all broadcast legislation is heard, before moving on to become the vice president of government relations for the radio giant. So the guy who was overseeing legislation that would affect the radio, that would affect the radio industry, now works for the largest radio company in the country and makes extremely good money on it. Briefly, moving on to your phone company, this was the biggest expenditure that we were able to track, was the amount of lobbying that were done by these companies. And they will tell you the reason that they spend so much money on lobbying is because they're more heavily regulated than most other businesses. And I will tell you that there is truth to that statement. But that may not be the case for long, because if there's one thing that a regulated company lobbies the most about, it's to become unregulated. The four former Baby Bell local phone companies and their rivals spent nearly $200 million lobbying Congress in the executive branch from 98 through 2004. Phone companies have contributed $65.5 million to federal campaigns and political parties and paid for about $276,000 worth of travel for members of Congress and their staff, bringing total spending to about an even $500 million from 98-2004. Verizon was number one on lobbying for almost $82 million. And collectively, those old Baby Bells, the local phone companies, far outspent what was their chief rival at that time, which was AT&T. And there's a really complicated regulatory fight that went on those days that I will not afflict on you. But the bottom line is, you used to have these scorpions in a bottle. One was AT&T and the other one was the Baby Bell companies. Now they're all joined together. And that's hardly ever a good thing when that happens. Now the two scorpions in the bottle, at least in terms of the industry is concerned, is you have these phone companies on one side and the only real countervailing influence you have on the other side is the cable industry. One may ask, what about the people? It's a good question to ask. There are about three or four public interest lawyers in Washington, and I happen to know all of them, who represent the people's interest in these things, and they do great work, and I admire them greatly, but I have to tell you that they are out. To say that they're outgunned is just a ridiculous understatement, and it probably becomes a little bit cynical, but the best thing that you can hope for in terms of making sure that the public's interest is taken care of in Washington is to make sure that there is some countervailing interest to a dominant industry. And that's a little depressing, but it's kind of the truth. In some ways, competition really is your only hope. You really do hope that these industries, these businesses do get into each other's business and they do duke it out. And that actually is going to help you in some way. But you would like to think that the public interest is represented in there somewhere. And we're trying. I mean, we're trying. At least trying to pay attention to what they're doing. Well, I am running out of time here, and I wanted to move ahead to I wanted to show you our media ownership database and close up on a couple of issues that are going on in Washington right now. Pardon my pile of papers. So, I bombarded you with numbers. The question is, what are these guys getting for all this money that they're spending? Well, to talk about the cable industry, they are once again finding, the industry itself is trying to find itself, trying to stifle a movement that would allow customers to choose which channels they want to watch. This is sort of like Jason in the Friday the 13th movies for the cable industry. This is an issue that just won't die. As I outline in Ron's book, the industry attempted what we call an AstroTurf campaign, which is a fake grassroots campaign, to convince Congress, the FCC, and the public that cable choice was somehow going to hurt minority programming. That didn't stick. Now Kevin Martin, who's the new FCC chairman, is in power. He loves the concept of cable choice, that you should be able to pick which channel that you want to watch and not have to get a whole stack of them. He likes this because it appeals to the family values crowd that doesn't want their kids switching back and forth from the Disney Channel to MTV. In a true Washington moment, the Martin-controlled FCC just released a study that shows that if viewers had their choice of channels, it would save them money. This contradicts an earlier study released under the anti-cable choice chairman, Michael Powell, that said cable choice would actually raise rates. The second study, by the way, actually has a section in it that says that the first study was wrong, which I thought was nice. You don't see that very often. By the way, the people who wrote the first study still say that the first study is still right. There was just pieces of the first study that were wrong. So the point is when you're talking about a monopoly and the monopoly says that if you do something to them and it's going to raise their rates, it's going to raise your rates. They could have saved a lot of paper on that issue. Talk a little bit about phone companies for a second, and then back to broadcast, and then I'll wrap it up. For the past several years, Verizon and SBC, now AT&T, have been spending, and this is probably the most interesting thing that's going on right now, I think, in terms of the technology, they've been spending billions of dollars to bury fiber optic lines all over American cities. The reason these companies are doing this is they want to get into the television business. The cable industry would prefer that they not do this. This is what I mean about what does telecommunications mean and what does media mean. You have to watch all of it or you're gonna miss something. The fight there is that the cable industry wants to keep them out. They want the phone companies to go through the same franchising process that the cable industry does. It's a lot of paperwork. I mean, you literally have to go through thousands and thousands of franchise agreements if you want to offer cable or television in the American cities. Phone companies would prefer to skip that process. This is a big fight in Washington, and actually it's something that's going on in the states right now, as you'll notice in one of the reports that we just did. Eventually, Congress will have to step in and make a decision, and it's going to be a compromise. Usually the way these things work is the representatives of the industry get together in a room with a couple of staffers from the various congressional committees that are important, and they hammer out an agreement, and you'll find out about it at some point, because that's what becomes legislation. I'm sorry to sound so cynical. That really is the way it works. On to broadcasting. Broadcasters are getting ready for another fight. They're actually gearing up. It's almost like spring training for football season. They're staffing up. They're getting ready to go to war again on this media consolidation issue, because contrary to popular belief, this issue is a long way from being resolved. In 2003, the FCC passed rules that would allow big media companies to get bigger. But a federal court remanded those rules and told the agency to try again. Now, since that happened, the FCC has been shorthanded. A couple of members have been gone. A couple of spots have been vacant. Well, now they're almost up to full staff. We've got the fifth member who's been chosen by the White House and is awaiting confirmation. So we're going to see that debate resumed probably this spring or summer. So get ready for that to become an issue. Now, the biggest issue in that area in media consolidation, and the one that's going to be watched the most closely, is this ban on broadcast newspaper cross-ownership. The company with the biggest dog in that fight is Tribune, which is the owner of the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. And there's also another smaller company called Media General. The idea is that they want to be able to own a newspaper and a radio station or a newspaper and a television station in the same market because it saves money, saves on overhead, they can share news staffs, et cetera. If you're a public interest person and a news consumer, this isn't a good development for you because you would prefer to see some competition in your news gathering. The concern is that's going to eliminate competition. So if you are interested in who owns the media in your area, we have this database that we made, which we're all very proud of. And I just wanted to show it to you real quickly. It's called the Media Tracker. The government, the federal government, the FCC, Congress, et cetera, they all rely on what are basically industry-generated statistics to decide on whether media rules make sense or don't. Very early on in this project, I decided that I wanted to get a list of radio and television stations in America, and I called the FCC and asked for it, and they said, call this company. I had to call the BIA Financial Network, and they wanted to charge me an arm and a leg for this list of radio and television stations. And they weren't going to let me display them on my website. So I built my own database of radio and television stations. It took about 8 months. This is the 2.0 version. 3.0, thanks to the Ford Foundation, I can't thank them enough, who had enough faith in us to give us funding for another go-around. We're going to do a new version of this media ownership database and hopefully get it done this summer. Anyway, I just wanted to show you the way it works. Somebody give me a Santa Barbara zip code. 93110. If this crashes, I'm just going to sneak out the back. This is a media ownership profile of the Santa Barbara area, and you can go from 40 miles up to 100 miles and find out who owns everything in your area. I could go on for hours and hours and tell you how long it took to put this database together, but I will not. I'm just sorry. just to show you what we collected, this is on top here is all of the radio stations. You can tell the Clear Channel owns the most radio stations in this market, which I don't think is a big surprise to anybody in this room. Sorry, I have to scroll down to show you what else is on here. We also show you all of the television stations in the area and who owns them, as well as the major newspapers and the cable provider, which I believe is Cox, and that's wrong, and I'm not sure why exactly. We also try to tell you a little bit about these companies, and if it's got a little profile sticker next to it, there's more information behind it. For example, if you look at Clear Channel, we'll tell you what their rank is in terms of radio. We'll also give you a little profile. We'll also tell you how much their revenue was, tell you how much their chairman makes, how much stock he owns, and whether they like Democrats or Republicans. Clear Channel likes Republicans. That's a surprise. Also, who their favorite recipients of contributions are and how much they spend on lobbying from year to year. So that ends my show and tell. I just have to show that thing off no matter where I go. I'm so proud of it. And thank you.
One question I had was, it looks like in terms of your studies, the dates were about 1998 to 2004. And I think it'd be really interesting, and maybe I'm just looking for a, sort of a gut feeling from you, prior to 1996, when the big telecom law was passed, do you have any sense of whether these kinds of efforts of lobbying and campaign contributions and everything had really ramped up before the passage of that sweeping telecommunications law?
Yes, there has been some studies. There have been a few studies on that. We went from 98 forward, particularly on the lobbying, because we were able to get those records electronically. Previous to that, you would have to go over to one of the House office buildings, go down into the basement. It's a very dark place. It's a very dreary place. You have to go through and look up these lobbyist filings one at a time. I don't recall the numbers right offhand, but there was a dramatic spike in lobbying, particularly in 1995, as they were formulating this Telecommunications Act of 96. I can actually get those numbers for you. We actually did collect that information, but it's, like I said, it's tougher to get because it was the pre-electronic filing day. And then it went back down afterwards. And the most spending was from AT&T. I think that they were number one in that stretch. And then from what were then the local telephone companies. And if you'll remember, the whole point behind the Telecom Act of 1996 was local telephone competition, which almost seems quaint. Not only is local telephone competition not an issue right now, local telephones isn't even an issue right now, I imagine, with people in this room. I mean, how many people here don't even have a landline at home anymore? Right now, check the age range on that. I'm fascinated by that. I cannot imagine not having a landline at my house. And I'm seeing so many people now that have a cell phone, and they are totally portable. It doesn't matter where they are. Their home phone goes with them. So you can see how far out of date that Telecom Act of 96 was. I didn't even think they could start to imagine the issues that they were going to be dealing with 10 years later. The whole thing's going to be tossed out and rewritten, by the way, in the next couple of years.
The 2003 loosening of the regulations were tossed out of court. Judges said that they were rejecting the FCC's arguments that this amount of deregulation was okay because the scholarship it was based on was capricious and superficial, I think was the wording. So what's going to be used this time around, this spring or summer, as they're gearing up, to support arguments for deregulation?
Boy, that's a good question. Arbitrary and capricious, I think, is the words
that's
they
right.
like
Thank
to
you.
Use.
Arbitrary and capricious.
The SEC has a really rotten record in terms of getting its rules held up in court. They just get thrown out routinely. Generally, they have a better go of it in the D.C. District Court, Federal District Court. It just so happens that this case was heard in Philadelphia, which was sort of a bold gambit by the people at Prometheus Radio and the others who were involved in that lawsuit, and they went to Philadelphia and got a more sympathetic ear. Interesting thing about that court decision was that it wasn't very nice. It was actually very stern, and they were very critical of the FCC for not giving any sort of justification for why it was allowing these media ownership rules to be to loosen up some. And a lot of people complained about those studies because that they commissioned a whole series of them. I can't remember. I think it might have been 8, maybe 13 studies that were generated largely based on industry data that were largely done from an industry point of view that, I know it's shocking, but said that the general conclusions were that further consolidation in media is going to be okay, with a ridiculous overstatement on the impact of the Internet. I don't know whether they're going to even commission a bunch of new studies on this. That's a good question. And I'm not sure who would do the studies either. So that would be something to pay close attention to. Maybe you guys should.
I have a facetious question you don't have to answer, which is, do you really think money is apolitical? But the second question that I really want to ask you is about something you said about not paying attention to the technology shifts and the little bells and whistles, because it seems to me in terms of what the tendency towards activist involvement is to say, okay, so how are we going to stay relevant when this technology, iPods or, you know, podcasting or whatever, becomes, you know, more widespread, rather than looking at what you talk about as the pipelines. So could you just comment a little bit more on the one focus rather than the other and why you think it's important?
Hit me with that one again.
Okay. Why pay more attention to the pipeline than to the sort of developing, the new technologies, all the proliferation of little bits and pieces?
That's a good question. In terms of the pipes themselves, I'm sure somebody is coming up with a new way to transmit information, but I don't know what it is. I think pretty much what you've got out there is what you've got out there, and it's that infrastructure, that communications infrastructure that's out there is extremely valuable. It's incredibly valuable, and it's generally a corporate asset. It's fiber optics. It's the airwaves. It's the wireless. It's phone lines. It's cable lines. These are assets that are held by corporations. No matter how good your technology gets, you're still largely going to be relying on these same sort of highways of information. And if you you want to be careful to make sure that these people who are controlling these highways are not just acting in corporate interest, that they should consider the public interest. Now, here's an interesting thing about this. The airwaves especially, back in 1934 when the FCC was created, the rule was that if you wanted a slice of the airwaves, for example, if your radio station got a license to control a piece of the electromagnetic spectrum, that you were supposed to be acting in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. Now, we've been arguing about what that means ever since 1934. To me, that means that a radio company, specifically a radio broadcaster, has to consider the public interest when it does its broadcasting. And that is an opening, at least, when you're talking about all wireless issues. That means wireless telephones. That means we're going to start watching, we're going to be watching television via a wireless connection through your cell phone. I mean, they're already doing that in certain places. Go to South Korea sometime. See what kind of wireless technology they've got. You're in on that, and the future of the communications is that wireless area, because we're figuring out, we're getting better and better technology to pump more and more information over those airwaves, and those airwaves are owned by you and I. And the law says that these companies, as they use them, that they are supposed to be concerned about the public interest. I don't know if that gets anywhere near your question, but if I was going to focus somewhere, that's definitely a place to focus.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.